Hi, everybody. Welcome to Fireside Chat number 237. Now, you might be wondering, how for the first time in 237 of them did I know the number? Actually, I knew it in number one as well, now that I think of it. The answer is, I already asked Megan, the owner of the most famous arm in America. Anyway, welcome to the Fireside Chat. So I do 52 of these a year. My chance to talk to you completely, spontaneously, and take your questions. And it's a wonderful experience, I hope, for you, and certainly it is for me. On about six occasions a year, so 46, it's just you and me, or really, I don't know if just gets me or I. It's just you and I, or just you and me. I'm thinking out loud. I love grammar, which drives people crazy. In any event, about six times I have a very special guest. If they're not special, we figure it's better to stick to the old formula of just you and I, or you and me. And I do have one this time as well, where we get a chance to have what they now call long-form interview, dialogue interview with someone. This is Otto, of course, America's most famous dog. And as I often tell you, it has not gone to his head. And by the way, last week I was in Chicago giving a speech, and a lot of people came over. You'll get a kick out of this. Okay. Came over with the Otto Tales book and asked that I sign it. And I signed each one on behalf of Otto, Dennis Prager.
That's nice.
On occasion, by the way, you will get another bigger kick out of this. And then, of course, I'll introduce you formally. People have on occasion, for whatever reason, and I'm totally honored by it, they will ask me to sign their Bible. So I write, this is where I got the Otto idea, I write, on behalf of God, Dennis Prager. Best wishes, Dennis Prager. It seems a bit odd to autograph the Bible like you're the author. A lot of funny things happen in public life. Anyway, my guest is Professor Dave Arnett of the Dallas Baptist University, a terrific university, which we'll hear a little more about, obviously, during our dialogue. He is a professor of management who teaches economics. I got that right, didn't I?
Yes, sir.
Yes, that's right. Important. Mm-hmm. His specialty, I learned just about 20 minutes ago, his original specialty was managing professional tennis players.
That's right.
Correct?
That's right.
How many people know that?
No, not many.
Yes. Yeah. Including your students, I suspect.
That's exactly right.
I think you should let them know. It could only enhance your credibility with them. I love people who have varied lives.
I've had a blessed life, Dennis, really. Yeah.
Well, look, I wouldn't expect you to know, but my view is that gratitude is the greatest of the traits. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing you expressed on our Fireside Chat speaks well of you. So Professor Arnett teaches, again, management teaches economics in the Department of Management at DBU, Dallas Baptist University. And his specialty is religion and economics. And that's really why he's here, because there is so much confusion, we both believe, with regard to religion. Specifically, we're talking Judeo-Christian religions, all the different religions that come out of originally the Old Testament, then, of course, the New Testament. And a lot of people think that religion teaches people to take views that are called socialist, progressive, left-wing, whatever term you wish to use. And I think it's a terrible misreading of the scriptures, but this is really this man's field. So welcome to the Fireside Chat.
Thank you, Dennis. Pleasure to be with you and with Otto.
By the way, I will add, the first guest I've ever had taller than me.
That's right.
You know, you must have this too, though. I'm 6'4", you're 6'4 and a half. Okay. Don't you have this, it's weird to see somebody your height?
Yes. Looking a person in the eye is unusual, isn't it, Dennis?
It's very odd for us. Yeah. Yes. I know there would be no way a normal person would know this.
You don't understand.
But yes, it's very true. So how did you get into this?
Oh, well, good. Thank you for the question. And greetings from my president at Dallas Baptist University, Dr. Adam Wright. When he introduced you there, he said DBU stands for God and Country, and he says it every time he's at a podium. And you made an impact at our university, so thanks for being
there. Thank you.
As a coincidence, about 5 days after that, Ginger and I had in our home about 10 students who were members of the Young Americans for Freedom, and a couple of them had been with you during the radio broadcast. Uh-huh. Oh, they were just going on and on about, oh, he was so interested in us, and he was so personable, and you made an impact. So
thank you
for coming.
That's very
to
sweet of you to say. Thank you.
You're welcome to come back. How did I get started in this? Wayne Grudem.
Oh.
Your friend Wayne Grudem.
Forgive me. I'm not interrupting. I'm just adding a very important little thing for those watching. I consider him one of the luminous minds of our time. He's many books. One of them, his guide to the biblical take on virtually every issue in life, is a stupendous achievement.
It is.
Wayne Grudem. I just needed to compliment him.
Yes. Our generation, Dennis, remembers John F. Kennedy having Nobel Prize winners in the White House and saying, there's perhaps more intelligence in this room, except for perhaps when Thomas Jefferson dined alone.
I know that quote.
Okay, I would put those two groups and maybe Wayne Grudem and Dennis Prager together. You have a third group.
That's very smart.
My students actually are required to listen to a 34-minute recording of you interviewing Wayne Grudem about his book, The Poverty of Nations.
Mm-hmm.
But how did it get started? Wayne Grudem, as you said, wrote Systematic Theology.
Right.
There's about 54 things that we Christians believe. I went to my friend Sergei Sedomitov, whom I teach with, and I said, has anybody ever done a systematic theology of economics? Because we know people will pull out a verse here and there, right? Whose image is on the coin, and they'll preach an entire sermon. But has anybody ever gone through the Bible in a systematic way like Wayne Grudem did, but for economics? So we wrote a paper. Sergei Sedomitov, by the way, you'll notice he has an unusual name. He is Ukrainian.
Hmm.
His family is safe, but his country is being torn apart. I chose Sergei Sedomitov to write the book with me, because he, until he was 11, he lived in Ukraine under Soviet socialism.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They say that 65% of American students, college students, would vote for a socialist, not after talking to Sergei, because he's lived it. The other reason I chose Sergei, at the time I was 65 and he was 40. We need to bring people along, don't we? I may not do this much longer. Sergei will. So we looked at Wayne Grudem's stuff, and he said he did it for the whole Bible. Can we do it for economics? So Sergei and I wrote a paper called 10 Biblical Commandments of Economics. We borrowed that from Moses, if you may have noticed, the 10 idea. And we presented it at something called the Christian Business Faculty Association. And I even asked my fellow congregants there, you know, has anybody ever done this? And the answer was no. Mm. So Sergei and I did it.
I know. I saw it. It's terrific.
We humbly, because if you're interpreting what God wants, you better be careful.
Mm-hmm.
We humbly came up with, Otto, you can't leave in the middle of class, Otto.
Okay.
He's not marked absent, though, so.
There's nothing we can do.
Okay. Thanks, Otto.
At least he was here for the beginning.
That's all right. Very good. We claim to have found 10 biblical commandments of economics.
Right.
This framework helps us understand and analyze up to 30 or 40 macroeconomic events, from taxes to tariffs to Social Security. And we hold up this list of 10 and analyze all these macroeconomic events and say, what does the Bible say? And to our knowledge, no one has done this before. So this has become a tool that we use. I do a podcast once a week, and I take a current economic topic, and I use this list of 10 as a tool for analyzing, are we employing an economy that is biblical.
So 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150, 200 years ago, in our country, asking what the Bible says about something would have commanded immediate attention and respect.
Right.
Today, it's so different, especially among the young, but even the middle age, and even people my age, who cares?
Right.
So I always say, okay, so you don't care what the Bible, the single most important book in the history of the world, even if you hate it, it's just a fact. So you don't care what it says. So what book do you care?
Yeah.
So, and then there's no answer to that. It's what do I think? So I just wanted to add why this is so critical. What is the most important book in Western and indeed world history say about economic matter A, B, C, or D should be of interest to anybody?
No, that's exactly right. And as the Christian economist, I'm in two camps. And what I have found in my study of Christian economics, and I include Judeo-economics in that because we can do the entire Bible, is that anyone who believes in a higher being, any religion, we believe that somebody gives us commands for how to behave and how to act. And so that's the concentration on the means, how we do things. Economists, and think about this next time you read any economic report, they always concentrate on the ends. What is the outcome? With hardly ever a question of, is this the right thing to do? Think about this the next time you read something in the Wall Street Journal and Barron's. They'll say, if we raise taxes, what happens? If we put on tariffs, what happens? They never question, are tariffs and taxes the right thing to do?
You mean morally right?
That morally or religiously.
Mm-hmm.
They don't ask that question. And I think that's what we're missing. So you're right. Where do we get these ideas? Where do they come from? Economists don't care.
Well, I'm not sure who does. I'll take a non-economic issue. People didn't ask, is lockdown the right thing?
No. And you were right about that, by the way. Early on, I was listening to you, and I said, well, this is Dennis Prager's view. We'll wait and see. As it turns out, you were right, but you're exactly right. They were concentrating on the ends, not the means. And they don't realize what they lost in the means. I've heard you say people die alone. What a sad thing to do. But they were concentrating on the ends, not the means. So was it the wrong thing to do, or what was the outcome? All economists concentrate on the outcome. And so I'm just trying to ask the question, how does this first century book inform a 21st century economy? And by first century, I mean Old and New Testament.
No, I fully
just
understand.
Just makes the slogan cumbersome.
Yeah, the first century combines the two testaments. Yeah. So I totally understood.
Yeah.
So you have your 10 commandments of economics, meaning what? These are the 10 basic principles that you derive from the Bible?
Yeah. We did, like Wayne Grudem, went through the entire Bible to try to figure out if there are themes, what are there? And we came up with 10. Now, the first one, and I think it's the most important, is freedom. I think the intersection of Christianity and economics is freedom. This will take some of your viewers back to Baptist or Methodist basement of their church. There's a painting by William Holman Hunt called Light of the World. And it's Jesus knocking at a door. What you notice right away is there's no handle on Jesus' side of the door. Most Christians believe that God, the greatest being that ever was conceived of, gives us the choice, the freedom, to accept or reject his invitation. If he gives us that freedom, we believe he wants us to have as much freedom.
That is a great point. It's an original point, I must say. That's correct. Look, the freedom began in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
Adam and Eve were free to say no.
And
we
want
to eat from the tree of knowledge.
You're free to follow the Ten Commandments.
That's correct.
Or free not to.
Right. What a good point. It's so basic.
Yeah.
If those of us who take this seriously believe, obviously, and even if you don't believe, that's what the text says. That God gave the human being freedom to reject God himself, correct?
Yes.
So obviously, we can have the freedom is pretty damn important to this God.
Thank you. Yeah, freedom is important, and that's the intersection of economics and freedom. So we should be as free as possible. We can't make people totally free because we have a fallen nature, right?
Right.
Genesis 1 is creation. Genesis 2 is the fall. It happens pretty quick, and we have a fallen nature. So if you put it on the end of a real simple spectrum, right? And so over here on this left end for your viewers would be socialism, which distributes goods by group force. And over on this end, free market capitalism distributes goods by individual choice. There's a dot across here. There's never been a perfect socialist society nor a perfect free market society. But we believe the Bible tells us to at least move it to this end.
Well, look, one proof, and this is a great subject, obviously great in importance, not great in happy, but given what you just said, let's go to the $64,000 question. Why do so many Jews and Christians think that the Bible wants them to be on the socialist side?
Dennis, if I could give a little sticky note to you and all the talk show hosts in America, it would have four words on it. It would say, conservatives think, liberals feel. Problem is, it would destroy your show because it would answer every question.
Right. Yeah. No, that's fair.
So they're feeling, not thinking.
Go on.
They're feeling, not thinking. When they say, the Bible tells us to distribute goods. And it does tell us to distribute goods, but the eighth commandment from Moses is don't steal. Doesn't that assume private property?
And the tenth is don't even want what belongs to you. Anything that belongs.
That's right.
It adds anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't covet. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, those are two that make it into our 10. Moses said, don't steal. So we stole that one from him. And he says, don't covet. Those are two of our 10. Those are economic principles, right? So covet means you want what somebody else has. Almost all discussions of inequality today are violations of the 10th commandment, don't covet. Almost all of them, because you want what someone else has.
This is one of the reasons that the most committed Protestants, the most committed Catholics, the most committed Mormons, the most committed Jews to their religion are on the freedom side of economics.
Yes.
Yeah. That's not insignificant.
Right, right. And as we said, Genesis 1 talks about the fall, okay?
Genesis 2.
Thank you. Well, it's good to have an Old Testament scholar.
You said it earlier, though.
Okay. Yeah. So we're fallen, then what happens, right? So we can't have a perfect society because we can't get out of our fallen nature, but we want to give people as much freedom as we can, right? So we're born cold. We are born fallen. Markets make us warm. See, this is where I have the greatest respect for the Catholic Church and for the popes. The current pope, Pope Francis, has said, word for word, markets are cold. No, he's 100% wrong. Markets are warm. Socialism is cold.
That's right.
We treat each other well when we are in markets because we're exchanging goods. If you love your neighbor as you love yourself, you'll give your neighbor products and services he demands. If you love yourself, you'll make a profit while doing so.
Not only that, on the warm and cold,
yeah.
How many people think that Department of Motor Vehicles is a warm place?
No, that's a great example.
The idea that government is warm, but the local guy who runs a store, he's cold?
Yeah.
It's so absurd, you had to have learned it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't come naturally.
Yeah.
If you'd ask 1,000 people who have left-wing ideas, just cold, ask them, it's funny I'm saying cold, out of nowhere, hey, where do you think you'll be treated with more warmth, at the local hardware store or the Motor Vehicles Bureau?
Yeah. Yeah. Back to the spectrum I had earlier with socialism on this and free market capitalism on this end. So as the problem with both of those ends is monopoly. In socialism, the government owns the means of production and distribution. On the free market end, if you left it without any control at all, it would form a monopoly. Then it would be cold. We're warm in the middle where people have to compete. Mm-hmm. See, in a competitive free market capitalist system, you have to serve somebody else before you get served. But on either end, when there's a monopoly, you don't have to serve others. And we are commanded to serve others.
So I will give you, in light of your Ukrainian colleague.
Yeah.
So I spent a fair amount of time in communist countries. That was my field of study.
Right.
So I remember going to restaurants in the Soviet Union. I speak Russian, so it was not a language problem. And it took about 45 minutes till the waiter would deign to come over to your table. Mm-hmm. Now, why? Why in America do they rush over? Oh, what can I get for you? And if you want 12 variations, oh, please, you know, hold the onions, but I'd like a little extra avocado. You do whatever you like, right? And they're smiling, and you're smiling. There was no such thing in any socialist country. They get paid whether they're nice to you or not nice. They get paid whether they show up in 45 minutes or 5 minutes. And they were paid, of course, a ridiculously low rate. The naivete of thinking socialism is more moral is painful.
Yeah, I did my dissertation on U.S.-Russian joint ventures. I've been to Eastern Europe every year for the last 8 years, except for COVID, perhaps. And you're exactly right. It's cold. It is markets that make us warm. You know the other thing markets do? It eliminates discrimination. You can't discriminate against
a group. Of course, you want their money.
Of course
you want
not.
Their money.
You have to be nice to them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you're forced
even,
to be.
Even if you don't like a group, you still want their money.
You know Hillsdale College, right?
Yeah.
A lot like DBU, great place. They put on something called Free Market Forum. So Ginger and I went last year, and it was in Charlotte. And we toured around some, and I noticed we encountered, as a white couple, we encountered a lot of black people. Why were they so nice to us, Dennis? Because
yeah,
we're in the market.
That's right.
Because they were in the market. See, the market eliminates discrimination. You can't discriminate in a market. The people you discriminate against will leave. But in a socialist environment, you can discriminate. Thomas Sowell, I think, is our greatest living economist. Thomas Sowell. And he says, look, government control lowers the price of discrimination because you can get away with it.
That's right. So talking about monopolies, what do you think should be done with Google and YouTube, et cetera?
Oh, that's a really great question. I've done two podcasts on antitrust, and I come down on the side of using as least power as possible. I think that's what Christ would want us to do. He wants us to have choices. He wants us to have freedom, but he wants us to use this power against antitrust as carefully as possible. I think the Bible would tell us this is a lack of competition and we've made a mistake. And I think that the Bible would tell us we need to do something to increase the competition in the market.
Do you have a specific suggestion?
Well, I think they've got some kind of an exemption. I can't state the law
right
now.
Yeah, they do. 230.
230, I was
going to
say.
Yeah, I know, because PragerU has been involved in this.
And perhaps that's been a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to give them that exception because we've given them too much power. Jesus didn't want power concentrated.
That's right. Well, that was your great point about either end at the very end is all power.
That's right. Yeah. And we don't want, the Bible tells us, to use power as carefully as possible. Why? Because the Bible knows we're a fallen people. Look, James Madison in Federalist 51 wrote, if men were angels, we'd need no government. Some 200 years later, Milton Friedman said to talk show host Phil Donahue, that takes you back, doesn't it?
Yep.
Said to Phil Donahue,
a liberal.
Yeah. Where are you going to get the angels to run this socialist system of yours? Isn't it interesting that 200 years apart?
Ugh.
James Madison
is
talking about angels.
That's right.
Milton Friedman says, angels, there are no angels.
So, interestingly, I just want to tell all my viewers here, I am debating a rabbi in Beverly Hills, California. You could go to my website, DennisPrager.com, where's Dennis? And if you're in Southern California, you really should come that night. On the question, he contends that human nature is basically good.
Oh.
An idea I find preposterous. And I'm sorry, I'm not insulting the rabbi. I'm not even mentioning his name. But this is the question. If people were good, we wouldn't care if concentrated power existed.
Yeah.
Oh, they'll use it beautifully.
Yeah.
There is no record of great power being used beautifully.
No.
Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. I didn't make that up. Lord Acton did.
Right.
But that is exactly the issue. Madison knew it, the Bible knows it, and Milton Friedman knew it.
That's right. Yeah. So, matter of fact, the Acton Institute is one of the best sources of information on Christian economics and other religions' economics.
Is it named after him?
Yes, Lord Acton.
Oh, how fascinating.
Yeah.
By the way, let me remind you folks that this is Professor Dave Tell me the last name again.
Arnott.
Yes, Arnott. Yes, it's an uncommon name.
Yeah, if it was French, it would be Arnaud, but it's Scotch.
Yes.
So it's Arnott.
Okay, that's the reason I was thinking Arnett, and then I knew it wasn't Arnett. So so it would be Arnaud in French, of course.
Yeah, but it's Scotch.
But it's Scotch.
Yeah.
Professor Dave Arnott is at the Dallas Baptist University, teaches in the management department, but teaches economics there. And he's really one of the leading thinkers in the country on the issue of religion and economics. I can't think of, there may be things equally important, but I can't think of more important, because I think that if we got our values from the Bible, we would have a much better world. You know, I have a great motto you would love. You want to defund the police? Have everybody live by the Ten Commandments. Then you can defund the police.
Yeah, they think that we're created good. We are not created good. Have they ever raised children?
Oh, thank you. Exactly. I don't understand how you could raise children and think that.
Yeah.
As I say all the time, I think you'll love this. I say, if children were basically good, you would say to your kid once or maybe twice, say thank you. Yeah. However, the average parent has said it 10,000 times.
That's right.
Why didn't it stick?
Because we're born with a fallen nature.
Yes, exactly.
So we've been fighting all this time. And that's the good thing about free market capitalism. It punishes the fallen nature. Socialism rewards the fallen nature. It's very simple. Which do you want to reward? Because in free market capitalism, you have to compete. I have to serve you before I get served.
That's the definition.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. By the way, again, on the freedom issue, I know from experience with audiences that even most Christians and Jews have no clue what's written on the Liberty Bell.
Oh.
It's a verse from the Bible.
Oh, okay.
Leviticus 25, and you shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. Mm-hmm. These founders knew that the book they most revered, and every one of the founders most revered the Bible, whether or not they were traditional Christians or not, the Bible was their book, and they knew that God wants us to be free.
Mm-hmm.
This was, by the way, not, unfortunately, in the history of religion, it was not always understood that way, because a lot of times religious regimes, certainly, I mean, the obvious example today is Iran. You have it's not obviously not Judeo-Christian, but there's no freedom, and they're very religious. Mm-hmm. We're assuming that one has the values that our founders had.
That's right. And another of ours, 10 Biblical Commandments in our book, Biblical Economic Policy, is that work is good.
Thank you. Go on with that.
God is working in Genesis 1. He's working. Adam and Eve are working. They're naming animals. They're taking care of the garden. After the fall, work becomes difficult, but it existed before the fall.
That's right.
We are called to work. And there's many government programs these days that say work is bad. Oh, I sincerely
disagree. That's Marx's view.
Yeah.
You should stay home and write poetry.
Yeah. Hey, the LA Times in 2014, this is a great article. They were saying these two activist groups were fighting over the rights to Karl Marx's writings. Think about this. The book in which Karl Marx said there should be no private property, right. Arguing over the copyright.
I love it. By the way, you're going to love this point. I have a feeling this will be a new one for you. Okay. And I have this because of my Jewish upbringing and studying so many years, the original Hebrew and so on. There's another commandment about work. It's in the Ten Commandments. 6 days you shall work. And the seventh, that in Judaism is considered a positive commandment.
Mm-hmm.
You must work six days.
Right, right.
Or 5 days as it happens in the modern age.
Yeah.
But work is good.
Yes, work is good. But we're seeing now something called the Great Resignation. People are quitting work. We're seeing people not going to work. This is not the biblical view. Work is good. God commands us to work.
You will love this story then. I was sitting next to a 29-year-old woman flying from Chicago the other day, and we had the same view about masks, so I knew we were kindred spirits. Turns out I was right. So she was telling me about her family. She has a 25-year-old brother, and their dad, unfortunately, is an enabler. The So her brother is 25, does not work. Hmm. The father is paying for his apartment. And it's driving this woman, who's a hard worker, crazy. And I said, well, what is your brother's reasoning for not working? And she said, oh, I'll tell you exactly what it is. He said, I will only work if I love the work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A study just last week said that like about 51% of Gen Z would quit a job if they weren't happy in their work. Okay, we are commanded to work.
Right.
I was teaching a section on Dallas Baptist University a few weeks ago on unemployment. My class starts at 8 a.m., kind of early. So a couple times a semester, I'll lock the door at 8 and put a little sign saying, you didn't keep your commitment to be here. Open the door in a few minutes. Just be patient. In the meantime, I give the students who showed up a reward for working, right? Okay, so I practice economics. And I said just off the top of my head a couple of years ago in that situation, piece of paper, three reasons why I work. Just spontaneous.
Uh-huh.
It got to be pretty interesting.
I'm sure.
It's because their answers from the Dallas Baptist University students, a lot of them had to say, well, I'm commanded and I'm working for others, right?
Wow.
Work is good. And
wait,
I do
did
it.
They say that? Or are you?
They said work is good.
Yeah.
And I'm doing it for others. Now, later that week, I was guest lecturing for a friend at a state university. I thought, let's ask them.
Yeah,
the
do the
question.
Same thing.
This
yeah.
could be interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's unscientific study, just anecdotal.
No, it's good. It's good.
But the two differences were those state students said, work is bad and I do it for myself.
Oh, my God.
Work is bad, and I do it for myself. My students said, work is good, and I'm doing it to serve others.
No, see? That's dramatic.
It is.
No, that is dramatic.
Yeah.
But even putting the self or others aside, work is bad?
Yeah.
That is such a horrible attitude.
Yeah.
For those of us who never in a day thought that, I won't do work unless I love it.
Yeah.
I worked from the day I left my parents' house because I had to, because I didn't want to be dependent upon my parents,
which
is also biblical. Therefore, a man shall leave his mother and father.
Yeah.
That's the first thing God said. Let's see, is that the first or is it not good for man to be alone? The first thing God said is not good for man to be alone. The second thing is a man shall leave his mother and father.
Okay.
Hello, grow up.
Yeah, that's the Old Testament version. And in the New Testament, it's Colossians 3:23, the key verse for John Calvin. Whatever you do, do it as unto the Lord. So that meant work is a service. Now, it's a service to others and it's a service to the Almighty. It's not for you. It's for others.
I wonder if you ever were asked this, but it leads me to ask you this. I'm not a big fan of retirement. Obviously, I haven't retired, to say the least. I'm working harder than ever, actually.
Yeah.
But what is your take on retirement?
Retirement is not a biblical principle.
I'm very interested.
Yeah, that's the simple answer. You can say it's contextual. I don't think so. I think there's something we should do. There are different kinds of work.
That's right.
There's something we should do.
That's right.
You don't have to call it work.
Yeah, my parents, till their late 80s, volunteered to teach kids in the inner city.
So retire from your regular job, but do something. Volunteer at the church.
Right, it's not made just for golf.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's or tennis. I want to honor your first love.
Look, recreations are fine, but there's no biblical retirement. It's not there. We need to continue to do something.
So your students at Dallas Baptist, are nearly all of them committed Christians?
Oh, a high percentage, I would say. I can't give you a specific percentage, but they're across all denominations. I mean, we are a Baptist university, but they're across all denominations.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, do you have any secular students?
Oh, yeah. I would say a very small percentage.
I'm sure.
Less than 5%, let's
say. But you can identify them in your mind.
I suppose, yeah.
So I personally wish half your students were secular. I'd want them to be influenced.
Yeah.
Do you agree with me or am I sort of putting words in your mouth?
No, I think last I knew, Christian colleges are graduating about 4% of the graduates. Perhaps that salt and light, is that enough? I don't know. We do the best we can. I've heard you say, Dennis, I'm not a pessimist. I'm not an optimist.
That's right.
I'm commanded to do. Is that what you said?
That's right.
At DBU?
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
I have a little different answer, but I like
your
answer.
Oh, well, that's fascinating because let's take the question then.
Okay.
My God, you're like the perfect guest. Dave Arnott, by the way, he is my guest professor in the management department, and he teaches economics. By the way, I'm happy to promote. Do you have a book out or do you have a podcast?
Thank you. The book is called Biblical Economic Policy, which I wrote with Sergei Seydamatov. And my podcast can be found on that place that doesn't honor Prager.
Which is?
YouTube.
No, we're still on YouTube.
Okay.
They don't honor us. That's true.
Excuse me.
Through battles, we're still on there. Yes. So again, the name of the podcast?
Yes, the Dave Arnott Channel on YouTube.
Okay,
and
terrific.
Once a week, I do about a 12-minute podcast that integrates a current economic event with the biblical understanding.
That's terrific. I'm going to watch that.
Thanks.
All right. So I have, you've seen the fireside chat. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So this is our video question. Take it away.
Hi, my name is Gabby. I'm 20 and I'm from Fullerton, California. So my question for you is, based on everything that's happening in our country, the state of the world, are you feeling optimistic for the future of our country?
Okay. So you heard it?
Yes.
Good. So, since you mentioned that you've heard my answer and that you have a slightly different one, I'll be very brief on mine, and it is a brief answer. I don't find optimism or pessimism particularly useful. More often, they really have people not fight. The optimist doesn't fight, things will turn out great. The pessimist doesn't fight, things are going to turn out lousy. So why bother fighting? I ask, what do I have to do? What does God want me to do? What does the nation want me to do? What does my conscience want me to do? I don't ask if I'm optimistic or pessimistic. I never think about that, to be honest.
Yeah.
So what's your answer?
Yeah, my answer is a little bit different. I think there's some bad things economically going on in our country. There's no question about that. I think the difference is I believe in providence. There was a guy who was kicked out of the Puritan society. He went down and started a city called Providence, because he thought it was God's providence that the Puritans kicked him out. He thought when something bad happened, God was joining him in his new venture. And not only does it happen with the building of actually that first church in Providence and the Pilgrim Chapel that you spoke of at Dallas Baptist University is a copy of that very same chapel.
Well, I didn't know that.
In Providence, Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I would say as a Christian, we believe that God works with us and he turns our bad into good. We make mistakes, he bails us out, so to speak. I've seen it happen time after time after time. Are you old enough to remember that maybe when you were a kid, you didn't swim because you might get polio? Were you taught to hide under your desk because the Cubans were going to attack?
Yeah, the Soviets were going to attack. Yeah, right.
Times were negative, right?
Right.
We got out of it. We've got out of it time after time.
I see. That's interesting.
Time after time. And so,
you are an optimist.
I'm an optimist.
Right. So, okay. So we're hitting a very sensitive subject, but why not? I always, more or less, always say what I think. So there is going on here a somewhat of a difference of an American Protestant and a Jew. We have suffered so horribly that for me to think it always turns out well after the Holocaust is not in my vocabulary.
No. And I understand with your history how you would have that point of view.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's not a theological response. It's a sociological response.
No, I understand that. Yeah.
Right. No, I know you do. I'm just making the point for everybody else.
Yeah. And in our belief system, too, we believe in a God who guards and guides and who is with us.
And all right. So I will ask you, if God does work out through providence that things will work out, why fight?
Oh, because we're commanded to. We're to work hand in glove with God. God does some things, we do some things. It's called God's sovereignty or man's responsibility. And both are true. God is sovereign. He could do whatever he wants. for some reason, he chooses to do it through humans. I don't know why. If I did, I'd be God. I don't know why. I believe that that's how it works, that I'm supposed to conduct myself in a certain way. And that's why I get so frustrated with the current political and economic environment. They don't even ask. They don't ask Christians, Jews, Muslims. They don't ask Hindus or Buddhists. They don't ask for any moral support. They just say, this is the outcome. And that's the two camps that I'm in. And I get continually more frustrated that they're not basing it in any moral framework at all.
So to take a non-economics issue, but it certainly goes back to freedom. According to Pew, almost 50% of young Americans, college-age Americans, will say, I believe in free speech, but not for hate speech, which means that they don't believe in free speech. Right. I mean, it's almost pathetic that they would even say that, because it means that they don't believe in it. So how will that turn around, in your opinion?
One of my podcasts is called Two Worlds, and I think our world will continue to split in two because I think it's based in a worldview. And people very, very seldom change their worldview. It's very unlikely that I'm going to become Jewish. It's very unlikely that you're going to become Christian. Our worldviews become pretty set. And I see this divide going on in America as a worldview difference, not between Jews and Christians. I'm just using that as an
example. And it's not between Jews and Christians.
No, it's not.
This is the obvious example.
I use that as an example.
No, no, it's a fair one. Go ahead.
People are not going to change their view.
Right. So what's going to happen?
So I think there'll be a greater split. I think two economies will emerge.
Florida and California.
Yeah. People
just to use examples.
People are moving from California and New York to Texas and Florida. We'll have two different Disney's mistake recently. There will be some type of a religious competitor to Disney emerge over and over and over again. There's a cell phone system called
Patriot Mobile. Yeah, Ben Shapiro and Daily
Wire
are starting one, correct? Yeah. I think I wish them only well.
Yeah. Patriot Mobile says, if you don't like the values of the big systems, come to us. That will get repeated, I believe, over and over and over again. I think that'll cause an economic split. I'm predicting, Dennis. I don't know. Mark Twain said, predictions are difficult, especially those about the future.
That sounds like a Yogi Berra-ism. That's exactly
a Yogi-ism.
Yes, it's a total. You know, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Twain was brilliant.
Yeah.
Wait, so I want to remember that one. Say it again.
Predictions are difficult, especially those about
the future.
Oh, I should make one more point about my optimism. I've been teaching at Dallas Baptist University for 29 years. And I've produced students, not me alone, but the university, who've gone on and made the world better. And I think they're going to make the world better. Angus Deaton teaches at Princeton. He was the 2015 Nobel Prize winner in economics. His book is called The Great Escape. How do we escape poverty? In the Old Testament, almost everybody's poor. In the New Testament, almost everybody's poor. Why are we so rich today? How did we escape poverty?
The C word.
What's that?
Capitalism.
Yeah, that's it. The very first line of the book by Angus Deaton, The Great Escape, says, life is better now than almost any time in history. Because I'm an optimist, I leave out the almost. Life is better now than any time in history. The Dave Arnott extension, it's going to get better. Why? Because we're graduating students, and I see them year after year after year. You saw them in chapel. You got a standing ovation in chapel, Dennis. People very seldom get a standing ovation.
Really? Is that true?
Yeah. Oh,
that's very sweet.
And those are the kind of students, in my experience, that are going to make the world better. Do we have troubles? Of course we do. We've always had troubles. We always have.
Look, it's great to hear you say this stuff. I certainly pray you're right. But all I care is not, again, whether one is pessimistic or optimistic, but is one fighting? And you are, obviously. Okay. With your podcast, your books, you came here for that reason. that's what matters. Is DBU in the fight? Do you sense that?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah. As I said, our president Adam Wright. Every
so
time he
tell me
the
this:
podium.
Why are so many Christian colleges and high schools woke?
Yeah, they're feeling and not thinking. And the sad part about that is you're supposed to think at the college level.
Yeah, no kidding.
They're not thinking. I've heard you say this so many times about universities. And of course, DBU is an exception to that, at least in my opinion.
I think it is.
I mean, Ginger, my wife and I, were on the way into a dinner the other night at DBU, and there's an obvious father and son there. So Ginger greets them and says, where are you from? California. Ginger said, oh, you're escaping. He says, we're from San Francisco. She said, you're really escaping. And they were escaping. They went halfway across the country to take their son to a place like Dallas Baptist University.
So you're right when I asked you what happened to so many Christian schools, that they're feeling, not thinking. But I 100% agree with you. Yeah. Nevertheless, the whole point of a biblical outlook is to think and not feel. Don't follow your heart is one of the most common warnings, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So how did they go wrong? I mean, if you'd have said Christian 100 years ago, you would have had an expectation of these values.
Yeah, they floated with the environment. I mean, the other class I teach at the university is called strategic management, and that is aligning yourself with the environment. These colleges and a lot of companies we could name have tried to align themselves with what they think is the environment. I'm afraid they're going to find out they're wrong. One of the podcasts I'm writing is called Woking is Not Working. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to work for them. It has worked for DBU. Adam Wright stands up just like when he introduced you and said, at DBU, we stand for God and country, and we always will. Look, there's people make a
choice. Well, leadership matters. So you have good leadership.
Yeah, I do.
I mean, when I think about, I mean, it's obviously a Catholic example. You're a Protestant example, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Notre Dame. I mean, this is like the Sistine Chapel, the Vatican of American Catholicism.
Right.
And look what happened.
Yeah. Yeah. All the colleges started that way. The slogan at Harvard originally was that each man, sorry, ladies, each man would find Jesus Christ as personal savior.
That was the original.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
John Harvard was a lay Presbyterian minister.
Huh.
And then they got too liberal, so they opened Yale, and it goes luck.
Well, Yale, this is a crack up. Yale's insignia is biblical Hebrew.
Oh, thank you.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And you know what it is? It shows you how steep they were in their knowledge of the Old Testament.
Hmm.
It's an obscure thing, the Hebrew words on the breastplate of the high priest.
Hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
That's why this, I'm telling you, if the average Yale student knew this, they would protest.
Yeah. Right. And so things change. People drift. What we want to find is some institutions who have stayed to their moorings. And there are some leaving their moorings now. Look, if we didn't believe in a God, I think it would really be distressful.
No,
without a God, I don't know how you'd get through life.
Hey, so I got a question for you that has nothing to do with economics.
Sure.
I have asked this of literally hundreds of Catholic priests and Protestant ministers. I understand you're not a clergyman, but it doesn't matter. You're a serious Christian. So, it's pure curiosity. I don't have any axe to grind here at all. Do you believe that a Christian is obligated to the Sabbath? It's one of the Ten Commandments.
Obligated to the Sabbath. I think my
general... To observe it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My general answer is yes, but if it's taking me somewhere, go ahead.
No, not at all. It's just been, you'll find this of interest. The answers that I've received are 50-50.
Oh.
And not only that, I've never been able to predict what the person would say.
No, the answer is yes. Yeah, of course.
So what is your Sunday like? I assume that's your Sabbath, Sunday.
It is my, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so what is it like? Do you go to church?
Yeah.
And then what do you do?
We'll recreate ourselves most of the afternoon. We have during the pandemic, I bought go-karts for our grandkids. We race the grandkids in go-karts around the pasture. We swim in the pool. There is some work that's done, if that's what you're getting at.
No.
I do some work.
Yeah. Well, so in Jewish life, and I'm a practicing Jew, so our big two things are the Friday night Shabbat dinner mm-hmm. and the Saturday Shabbat lunch. Mm-hmm. So is there an equivalent to that of a family dinner or lunch in your life?
In my life, no.
All right,
no.
Okay.
Have seven grandkids, and I see them every week. I drive all over the Metroplex to see them, and I'm honored to see them. Ginger and I are so blessed to have good kids and good grandkids and a family that stays together. We don't have a regular weekly or monthly. I have a regular. I see all seven grandkids every week. I'm just blessed to have the time and flexibility and ability to do so. I'm really blessed.
Did your kids go to DBU?
My son did. My daughter didn't, but she taught there for a while.
Son-in-law
attended there.
What did she teach?
She taught, she got a degree in international relations from American University in Washington, D.C., and she taught U.S. government for us.
So your Ten Commandments, we've discussed property. Well, we've discussed freedom, obviously. Mm-hmm. That was number one. And then we discussed work.
Right.
And now property. Why don't we go to property?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. I believe that God wants us to have our own property. I mean, it just makes sense.
What dignity is there without property?
Yeah. I mean, the Eighth Commandment says don't steal. Well, that assumes private property, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So private property qualifies both on the Christian and the economics end. Because as a Christian or a Judeo-Christian, it is the right thing to do. And then we show that it proves that it makes people richer. Exchanging goods. Trade is good is one of ours also, which we can jump to here.
Go ahead.
I asked the students at the university, I got 50 to 70 of them in the class. And I said, athletes, raise your hand. Let's talk to you. So name where you're from. If you don't mind, what denomination do you belong to or what's your belief system and where do you live? And so we go through and I find out how many of them are Baptists from Dallas. Almost zero.
Huh.
We trade. And so I ask the students, why don't we limit our athletic teams to Baptists who are from Dallas? Well, the obvious answer is they'd be terrible. We trade.
It's a good teaching
unit thing. You trade. When you trade, you get richer. When you trade what you have for what you don't have, you get richer. So Dallas Baptists go elsewhere to play. Presbyterians from us come out to our team. This is a good thinking about, do we trade? When we trade, we get richer.
You were reminding me of an insight I learned many years ago when I spoke at Stanford. And I interviewed students and professors, and the only conservative students that I met were all on sports teams.
Oh, interesting.
It's very, so when you said about trading and so on, and I was thinking, there's a lot of conservative principles, even biblical, if you will, in sports.
Yeah.
For example, that's exactly where you can't follow your heart. Mm-hmm. I remember the story of the guy, the manager is a baseball game. It's a true story. The manager signaled to the third base coach who gives the sign to the batter that he wanted him to bunt. Mm-hmm. Guys were on base. He wanted him to bunt, sacrifice guys to next base. The guy swung and hit a home run, and he was fined.
Okay.
And I always use that example of even if it turns out right, there are rules, man.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And so, again, that's what we see in so many economic decisions today. What is the outcome? Not is it the right thing to do?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a perfect a perfect example for you.
Yeah.
Let's see what else the folks have, some of the folks who don't care for our view of life have written in. It's so weird being raised by Christians and spending your entire childhood being told to care about others. Then one day they're just like, you're not actually supposed to care about others, you stupid socialist. This is, and it's not meant to be an insult at all, but this is an example of feeling overthinking.
Right.
So the notion, forgive me for answering first. I have such passion on this, I can't hold myself back. The record of socialism is squashing people's lives. But people like you, good-natured folks, and I assume you are, whoever you are seduced by the jargon, by the rhetoric of socialism into thinking, oh, this is kind, this will help inequality, this will be good for people. But it always, always ends up in squashing liberty and very often in violence. The record of socialism is awful. If you love liberty and you love people taking care of people, freedom is your best opportunity.
Well said. And what you're talking about is power. And so you've talked about the outcome. Now let me talk about why it's wrong, is because it's an exercise of power. Dennis, the government has no money. They must take before they can give. There's no biblical command to take. There are biblical commands to give for Jews and for Christians.
Oh, yes. And by the way, I might add that religious Jews and religious Christians give more charity than secular folks.
Yeah, there's a book by Marvin Alasky that talks about it. And Arthur Brooks talks about it in his book. Gross national happiness. Yeah.
That's a fact. That's not an opinion and self-serving.
Yeah. So to the person who asked the question here, she likes socialism. So she likes taking? There's no biblical command to take. Dennis, I've been teaching for 29 years, and I think I've made the offer to every one of my students. Would you like to redistribute some of your grade to students who didn't get up and make it to class at 8 a.m.? So far, I'm 0 for 5,000. Not one student.
Interesting. You would probably be 0 for 5,000 at Berkeley.
Yeah, of course. Because when 65% of them say they're for socialism, they're for goods being distributed to them. But when I offer to distribute them from them, well, no, I don't want that, Professor Arnott. I had a student actually in an online class, wrote a pretty convincing short argument for redistribution. So I awarded her the full 10 points, then redistributed 3 points each to two students who didn't participate.
Great. I think that's great.
She accused me of theft.
Yeah. Well, she was right, but she doesn't realize the applicability in economics.
Thank you.
Dave Arnott is my guest. He's a professor at Dallas Baptist University. And I just might add, while the vast majority of your students are Christian, it is open to anyone.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
So just if you like this man, and I don't know how you wouldn't, and you like this nice message, it's something to consider for your kid, for yourself. Yep. Let's see what the next one is. Here it is fascinating. Reminder that Jesus was an anti-capitalist person of color who was constantly calling out the BS, he spells out the BS, and corruption in both the church and the government, and was eventually executed by Roman police who considered him an enemy of the state. Happy Easter, abolish the police.
Okay.
That's deep.
Okay.
Abolish the police.
Yeah,
why T.S. Butch Queen? I'm just curious, why do you want to see more people raped, more women raped, to be precise? Why would you like to see more murder? Because abolishing the police would lead to mass murder and rape and theft and beating. This, I think, of all the positions, that's the one that truly lives your motto of feeling, not thinking.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so one of my podcasts is called The Prophet Who Made a Profit. Of course, Christians believe Jesus was more than a prophet.
Right.
But he was a good Jew.
Right.
So to keep the command to give, he had to make a profit.
Right. Think How do you it. Give what you don't have?
Yeah. Socialism says from each according to his ability, to each according to his need.
Right. Who determines that?
So if you only get what you need, how do you give?
Oh, that's a good one. I never heard that objection. That's good. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Right. Where will the money come from to give to the poor if people are not earning it and capitalism is not the venue or the avenue?
Father Robert Sirico, Sirico.
At Acton.
The father of Acton.
I know him well.
The founder of Acton, do you? Wrote Defending the Free Market. In USA Today, just a couple months ago, he came out and asked the Pope, how do we feed the poor?
Right.
Without the market.
Yeah.
And Father Sirico is exactly right. We have to make a profit. Jesus made a profit. You know maybe more about the first century than I did, but wouldn't a 13-year-old Jewish boy go to work with his dad?
Yeah, well, it was even true anywhere. You worked early in life.
So maybe...
Yeah, but 13, you were bar mitzvah, you were an adult.
So 13 to 30, he worked with his dad.
Right.
They had to make a profit to give.
That's right. That's exactly correct.
Okay.
You're doing really important work.
Well, thank you, Dennis.
I got to tell you, this has been a joy.
Yeah. I've followed you for a long time. And again, thanks for coming to the university. And you really made a difference in the lives of our students. Can I leave you with just a couple of recommendations?
Because
some people will say, this is good stuff. Where do I get more?
Yes.
Well, first the Jew, then the Gentile. And I'm saying this to my students every semester. You want to continue to study economics? PragerU. It's number one.
Thank
Number
you.
Two in economics, anything written by Thomas Sowell. Hmm. I think he's our greatest living economist, in my opinion. Now, on the Christian side, there's a book called Money, Greed, and God by Jay Richards. Great book.
Oh, I gotta read that.
Money, Greed, and God by Jay Richards. And fourth, so I'm the Gentile, I'm last, I do a podcast every week. Start with Prager. Oh,
that, by the way, I don't know if everybody got that. You're a Gentile. You put yourself last. You mean Christian humility? Is that what you're referring to?
First the Jew, then the Gentile.
Yes. It cracks me up. I truly, you talk about blessed. I too am blessed. One of my blessings is my immersion in both the life of Jews and Christians. Mm. Maybe uniquely so in America. So I really know both communities well. And we have virtually identical values, obviously not the same theology, which is a separate issue. And, but also there are social differences that emanate from the theology. You're more humble than we are.
Oh,
yeah, okay. I have to say that's true. On the other hand, we do better fundraising.
Okay.
Right. This is right up your alley with economics and religion.
Oh, that's great.
So I will tell my famous story. The first time I spoke at a church, I had my whole life religiously had been Jewish. The first time I spoke at a church, the pastor gets up. You know, he needs money, obviously, for the church to operate. Yeah. And he goes, you know, well, people will be coming around collecting and we want you to pray on it. And whatever the Holy Spirit prompts you to give, please give whatever your heart prompts you. And I'm thinking, is this guy serious? What if the Holy Spirit says $5?
Okay.
Yeah, that's not our attitude, okay? Our attitude is, give man. The synagogue needs to operate. Hello.
Yeah.
Anyway, this has been terrific. Yeah. And I have very warm feelings. And obviously now to you, but certainly to Dallas Baptist. And thank God you guys exist, because the crisis in Christian academia is a very serious one. Yeah. It's certainly in Jewish academia that is it. I have a very dark saying I say to audiences now. I don't care what religion you're a member of, as long as you're embarrassed by it.
I've heard you say that. You're doing good work, Dennis. Keep doing it. Keep getting people to think, Dennis.
Thank you.
Keep them thinking.
I will. Well, this has been a very special time. Dave Arnott is the professor at the management department teaching economics. Follow his podcast. Follow his works, his books. He's doing really wonderful work. This has been a pleasure. This is the Fireside Chat. On behalf of the snoring Otto, thanks for watching. Thank you for watching this video. To keep PragerU videos free, please consider making a tax-deductible donation.